Chapter 2. Janice Steele was not and never had been a cop's wife. She was married to a cop and a strike force cop at that, but it was something she acknowledged only in a vague, intellectually sort of way, and not at all emotionally. It was a role she simply did not choose to play. Being a cop's wife entailed certain things that she could not accept. It meant accepting the fact that her husband didn't have the sort of job that he could leave behind at the office. It was with him 24 hours a day. He couldn't help but bring it home with him. A cop's wife had to live with the fact that when her husband left for work in the morning, there was a strong possibility that he might not come back. She had to live with the fact that every single day her husband had to deal with human nature at its very worst, and, all too often, he had to dip into the reservoir of his own baser instincts in order to contend with that, a process that was emotionally draining and deadening to the spirit. She had to live with the reality that her husband was a soldier in a never-ending war, a war in which he often had to kill, and that was part of him that she really didn't want to know. It was simply too unsettling a concept for her, so she had learned to tune it out, to edit her reality in a manner that made it possible for her to live with him. It made for a difficult relationship. Sometimes it seemed as if they lived in two separate dimensions that occasionally overlapped, creating a third, somewhat nebulous dimension that defined their life together, a life in which, in certain ways, the two of them did not really connect. Yet, in spite of this, their marriage had lasted for the better part of 17 years. They had two children, Corey, 14, and Jason, 16. They were the glue that held their uneasy relationship together. Janice had been introduced to Steele by her best friend, Shelley Taylor, whose brother, Mick, was Steele's partner on the strike force. Shelley and Janice both worked for the city administration, and they'd met at a small, intimate dinner party at Shelley's apartment. The initial chemical attraction between them had been extremely powerful. Janice had only been 19 when they met, statuesque and drop-dead beautiful, with honey-blonde hair and dark green eyes, a full, lush figure with long and shapely legs that she was proud of and showed off to good advantage. Steele had been 23 and already a corporal in the strike force, muscular and handsome, with dark hair and a pale gray eyes that had unusual intensity about them. He fell in love with Janice at first sight. Janice, on the other hand, was ambivalent about her feelings from the very first. She didn't like cops and only tolerated Mick because he was her best friend's brother. She didn't care for their hardened, cynical outlook on life, which she nevertheless had to admit was somewhat justified considering the world they lived in. Yet it was a world in which she'd always tried to keep at arm's length as much as possible. She didn't care for their aggressiveness, for their swaggering arrogance, or for the way that they looked at everything in simple terms of black and white. She and Mick never agreed on anything, and they argued frequently, with Mick often chiding her for her naive and, to him, unrealistic attitudes. The last thing that Janice ever wanted was to become involved with anyone like Steele, who was part of a world she didn't really want to know about. To her, cops were like attack dogs. She had conceived that they served a useful purpose, but she wouldn't want to have one in her home. Nevertheless, she found herself irresistibly drawn to Steele in a way that she found quite disturbing. The powerful sexual attraction that she felt for him was unnerving. He didn't seem like a lot of the other cops she'd met. He was soft-spoken and not very talkative. God help me, she had thought, the strong, silent type. And when he did speak, he didn't waste a lot of words. He didn't have that swaggering sort of braggadocio that most other city cops she'd met had, that cock-of-the-walk attitude that so infuriated her. And he didn't talk cop talk or dwell upon his exploits as a lot of them had a tendency to do. Whenever Mick would start one of these, hey, remember the time when, war stories, Steele would deftly but surely change the subject, bring it back to them, to her and Shelley, wanting them to talk more about themselves. He exuded a quiet sense of confidence and self-awareness that she found very sexy. She found herself flirting with him and was surprised to realize that she wanted him, a desire more intense than she'd ever felt before. There was nothing logical about it. It was purely gut-level thing. Or perhaps, she thought to herself wryly, it was on a level slightly lower than the gut. It both angered and excited her at the same time. Their eyes had met repeatedly during the evening, and their bodies had carried on an unspoken conversation more blatant than anything either of them would have dared to say aloud. And when he offered to walk her back to her apartment, she already knew that she would ask him in and go to bed with him. And it had been incredible. The best sex she'd ever had. She was so turned on and wanted to consume him and to be consumed. It was as if planned and preordained by some force more powerful than either of them, some force that had given them both a deep and instinctual physical knowledge of each other. When their lips met in their first kiss, it was absolutely perfect, so intensely satisfying that she never wanted it to end. Their bodies moved together as if in a choreographed dance, as if they were two parts of the same machine that had been precisely tooled to fit together. They knew somehow just where to touch each other and how. And they fell into a carnal rhythm so exquisitely timed that they might have been making love together for years. And later, after they were both completely spent, they had lain awake all night talking softly with Janis nestling in his powerful arms, wondering just what in God's name she had gotten herself into. It was only a casual thing, she kept telling herself. He's sweet and having sex with him is great. God, is it ever great. But I'm not going to get involved. Yet, in spite of her intentions, she kept on seeing him, intoxicated by what they experienced in bed together, hooked on his strong yet tender masculinity, taking comfort in the mere fact of his presence. And when he finally asked her to marry him, she had immediately said yes, while somewhere deep inside a part of her had cried out, "Oh God, what am I doing?" Mick Taylor was the best man at their wedding, and Shelley had been their maid of honor. The man had wanted a department wedding, complete with an honor guard of Strike Force cops, but Janis had put her foot down firmly and insisted upon a quiet, small, and very private ceremony. She was not going to have her wedding turned into some sort of quasi-military drill. Yet even while the vows were being exchanged, the part of her had rebelled, wanting to flee in terror. When it came time to say, "I do," she had fully intended to scream, "I don't!" But one look at his eyes and she had melted. She heard herself saying the words, "I do," and then she heard the minister pronounce them man and wife. And in that moment, she had felt a brief, sharp pang of misery, thinking, "Well, that's it. Now I've gone and really done it." And then he kissed her, and all her doubts were instantly dispelled. That bizarre, hot and cold ambivalence was to remain with her throughout their marriage, and it became more evident as the novelty of their relationship gradually wore off, evident enough for Steele to realize that there was something wrong between them, although he couldn't really have put a finger on it. At times, she seemed angry with him for no good reason, seemingly desperate to pick a fight, and Steele simply couldn't understand it. He thought that it was something somehow lacking in himself, and he racked his brain trying to figure out what it might be. Sometimes he would come home to find her just wanting to lash out at him, to make an argument out of the most insignificant thing. And at other times, he would come home to a harlot, a woman dressed in her sexiest and most revealing lingerie, of which she had accumulated quite a large collection. The lights turned down low and music softly playing with some wine set out and candles lit. At such times, his desire for her would be rekindled with the same ferocious intensity they had both experienced the first time. And no matter how tired he felt, no matter how horrible a day it had been out in the streets, they would make love with fierce abandon in the bedroom, on the couch, or on the living room floor. And then for a time afterwards, they would bask in the rosy afterglow of their passion. But as time wore on, the afterglow seemed to fade for her more and more quickly, and she would turn from him and want to sleep without talking, sometimes with an air of resentment Steele could not account for. And it had even become more pronounced after she became pregnant with Jason. And he was 16, so that was about a year in. Her sexual appetites became insatiable, but her resentment for him increased as well. It never affected their ability to have sex, but it added tremendously to their mutual frustration afterwards. While they were making love, somehow everything seemed perfect. In the tender moments, she would apologize for being such a bitch. And he would assure her that she hadn't been, that he understood, though both were lies, and they would promise each other that things would be better. But they only grew worse, and Steele simply didn't know what he could do about it. Things did get better for a while after Jason was born. They focused on their relationship on him. And for a while, things improved between them, but their son was the only common ground where they could meet outside of the bedroom. For a while, Jason completely filled their lives, but gradually the old tension started to return. It ebbed once more when Janis became pregnant with Corey, and after she was born, the new addition to their family once more occupied all their time and their attention, but inevitably, they began to drift apart once more. There was a large part of Steele's life, a very important, crucial part, that Janis simply didn't want to know about. Steele had long since come to realize her antipathy towards his job and her desire not to want to be involved in it. Sure. He never talked about his work when he came home in order to protect her from a part of his life she found abhorrent, but at the same time, it denied him a necessary outlet. If he couldn't talk to his own wife, couldn't share his feelings and his troubles with her, who could he talk to? Fortunately, he found someone who could provide him with that much-needed sympathetic ear. His name was Father Liam Casey, a Catholic priest who was 20 years Steele's senior and worked out of St. Vincent's on Lexington and 66th. They had met when Steele wandered into the church one day, not really knowing why. He was a fallen Catholic who hadn't been to church since he was about 14. Sometimes he wasn't even sure if he believed in God, but some things run very deep, and when he found himself lost and confused, Steele had gone to the church, if for no other reason to seek solace in the old, familiar trappings of the faith. He had gazed upon the ceiling, looked down at the rows of pews, and found himself drawn to the confessional. Without really knowing why, he had entered and sat down. The small screen slid aside, and for a moment, Steele simply sat there, trying to think of what to say. "Bless me, Father, for I have sinned," he finally said hesitantly. "It's been, around a dozen years or so since my last confession." "Hmm," said the voice on the other side of the screen. "Guess I'd better make myself comfortable, then. This could take a while." In spite of himself, Steele smiled. "Well," he sighed, "I'm not really sure where to start." He hesitated for a long moment. "I've killed some people." "I see," the unseen priest said, his tone neutral. "What do you mean by some?"
You mean how many?" Steele said.
"Hell, I don't know. Sorry. A few hundred, I guess. Maybe more. I've never really counted." Silence. "I should probably tell you I'm a cop," said Steele quickly. "I'm on the strike force." "Ah, I see." The voice sounded relieved. "What, does that make it okay?" Steele asked.
"Well, from a purely technical standpoint, no, but it's a damn load off my mind."
Steele frowned and stared at the partition. "Are you sure you're a priest?"
"Is the Pope Catholic?"
"That's pretty strange talk from a priest," said Steele.
"We live in pretty strange times, my son," the priest said. "But you're quite right. The bishop wouldn't like it. Anyway, to hell with him. What's on your mind?"
Steele grinned and shook his head. "Damned if I know, Father. I haven't done this sort of thing in a long time. I've kind of lost the habit. To tell you the truth, I don't even know why I'm here. I don't really feel like confessing anything. I mean, it's not like saying a few Hail Marys would make it right, you know."
"I don't know," the priest said. "Are we speaking theologically or from a purely secular philosophical standpoint?"
Steele thought about it for a moment. "The latter, I guess," he finally said. "I don't know. How can you absolve anyone of killing people? I'm not sure I ever really bought into that. You know, you list your sins, a priest gives you a token penance to perform, and then you leave with a clean slate. I'm not sure it really works that way."
"I'm not sure it does either," said the priest, "but what I'm hearing from you is that you're really not looking for forgiveness."
"No, I suppose I'm not," admitted Steele. "I deal with what I have to do in my own way. I guess I just wanted someone to talk to, and having been raised Catholic, I wandered into a church instead of some shrink's office. But I'm not really very comfortable talking to someone when I can't see their face."
"In that case, why don't we go across the street and have a couple beers," the priest said. "Or can't you drink on duty?"
"I'm not on duty," said Steele. "What about yourself?"
"I'm an Irish Catholic," the priest said. "The only time I'm not supposed to drink is when I'm saying Mass. What do you say? I'll buy."
"Okay," said Steele. "Fine, meet you outside."
The screen slid shut. Steele met the priest outside the confessional. He was of medium height and stocky with short gray hair and beard, and alert green, light green eyes with gold flecks in them. He wore the Roman collar over the traditional black shirt front, but otherwise he was casually dressed in a rust-colored tweed jacket and a pair of dark brown slacks. He was wearing cowboy boots.
"Liam Casey," said the priest, holding out his hand. "Donovan Steele," they shook. "This is what the clergy's wearing nowadays?"
"It's comfortable," said Father Casey with a shrug. "Besides, I don't like wearing black. It makes me look too much like a cop." Steele grinned.
"Come on, let's go bend some elbows. God's work is thirsty work."
They went to a small bar across the street and ensconced themselves in a dark booth at the back. The pretty waitress greeted Father Casey by name and dimpled when he flirted with her, then went to get their beers. Father Casey ordered a full pitcher to save her poor, tired little feet.
"I don't remember any priests like you when I was a kid," said Steele.
"Oh, we don't walk around dressed up like funeral directors with dour expressions on our faces, you know," said Father Casey, smacking his lips over his first sip of beer.
"Ah, that hits the spot. So tell me about your marriage."
Steele's eyes widened slightly.
"Is it obvious?" he said.
"No, not really. Merely an educated yes," said Father Casey.
"You don't have the air about you of a man who's racked with guilt. And from what you've said, I gather you've reached your own philosophical acceptance of what you do as a policeman. And since you're with the strike force, what you do must at times be very difficult indeed. Yet you're obviously troubled, and since we sat down, you haven't stopped fiddling with your wedding ring, so I gather your troubles must be at home rather than job-related."
Steele glanced down at his hands and made a grimace.
"You'd make a pretty good detective, Father."
"Call me Liam," said the priest, "unless Father makes you feel more comfortable."
"No, Liam's fine. My friends just call me Steele."
"A hard name for a hard man in a hard job," said Father Casey with mock gravity. Steele grinned.
I think I like this a lot more better than the confessional," he said.
Father Casey shrugged. "The whole world is a confessional. Some places are simply more informal than others." He raised his glass.
"Cheers!"
They drank. At first, Steele felt awkward discussing his private life, but as he loosened up, he told the priest about his marriage. He found it remarkably easy to talk to Liam Casey, and he soon told him more than he told anybody else, even his best friend, Mick Taylor. Father Casey listened attentively, occasionally nodding or giving a small grunt, and when Steele was finished, there was an empty pitcher on the table, and they signaled the waitress for a refill.
"Well, I don't pretend to be an expert in matters sexual," Liam Casey said, "though I'm not entirely without experience in such things. This was long before I took my vows, you understand. And in any case, from what you tell me, there doesn't seem to be the focus of your problem, although in some respects that may be your entire problem. It depends on how you look at it."
What do you mean? Said Steele, puzzled. Well, for one thing, do you love each other? Father Casey said. Asked, what kind of question is that? Steele said, surprised. We've got two kids. Of course we love each other. Don't get your back up, Father Casey said. Having children with someone and loving them are not necessarily the same thing. We've established that you can't keep your hands off one another and that you have no trouble satisfying each other in bed. But what about the rest of your relationship? It doesn't sound to me as if the two of you communicate very well. In fact, it doesn't sound as if you communicate at all. Sex seems to be a substitute for that. It's all fine and good after all these years. You still lust after each other like a pair of randy goats. But that's not necessarily the same thing as loving each one another. But I do love Janice, said Steele. Does she love you? Steele hesitated. I always thought she did. Love can be a very tricky thing, said Father Casey, especially when it's all tangled up with sex. On the surface, it sounds as if your wife was, and apparently still is, overwhelmingly fixated on the purely physical aspects of your relationship. Of course, not having heard her side of it, this is all strictly shooting from the hip, you understand. But from everything you say, it doesn't sound as if she's very satisfied with the other elements of your marriage. She obviously takes satisfaction in the children, which answers her nurturing needs, but the fact that things seem to have disintegrated somewhat within a few years of their birth of each of your children would seem to indicate that the children are not a resolution to your problem. Bleh. They very seldom are. He poured himself another glass of beer and took a sip. It seems to me that a large part of the problem stems from who and what you are, he said after a brief pause. From what you tell me, it sounds as if she'd really like to be able to separate you into two different people, the husband and the cop. The husband is the man she'd like to have at home, to be the doting father to her children and to make love to her. The cop is someone she'd rather not let in the front door. Well, in a way, she doesn't, Steele said. I never talk about my work when I'm at home. Yes, but that still doesn't mean it doesn't come home with you, said Father Casey. You are what you do, Steele. You can no more stop being a cop when you come home than you can stop being yourself. I'm no psychiatrist, though I've studied some psychology, but it sounds to me as if your occupation represents a reality that Janice simply doesn't want to deal with. There's a part of you that she resents because it frightens her. The world has become a truly terrifying and savage place. Here in Midtown, she's managed to isolate herself from all that to some degree, and she doesn't want to know about it. That's not at all uncommon. It's a simple fact of human nature. We all try to avoid what frightens us, but being a policeman, especially a strike force cop, you bring that reality home every single day. You're a living reminder to her that her security is, at best, a very tenuous thing. She doesn't want you to bring home any of your friends on the force, and she won't socialize with them or with any of the other wives. She doesn't want to hear you talk about your job. She wants to pretend it simply isn't there, that part of your life doesn't exist. Only it does exist, and that's the problem. She seems to define her relationship with you in terms of your sexuality and your children, but there's a part of you, a very important part, that she apparently doesn't accept at all. What am I supposed to do? Asked Steele. Quit the force? Could you? Steele hesitated. I don't think so. I don't think so either, Casey said. Otherwise, you would have done it long ago. Besides, I'm not sure that would solve the problem. Even if you were to quit the force, there would still be the question of your past, of what you were, and I'm not sure that Janice could forget that. So what you're saying is there's no solution, Steele said, disheartened. No, said Father Casey, I'm not saying that at all. Your problem is not beyond solution, but it will take a lot of work. The fact that you've remained together for so long is encouraging, and the children make for a strong incentive to get your difficulties resolved. That always works. But it will require time and effort. Sexual bonding can be very powerful, but when it's not reinforced by a more personal, spiritual bonding, it inevitably tends to weaken over time. You're both going to have to take the time and trouble to really get to know each other all over again, to give yourselves an opportunity to fall in love again. It might help if I could talk to Janice and see you both together, or if she's uncomfortable with talking to a priest, I could refer you to a marriage counselor. In any event, it's important that you both face the problem and stop using sex and the children as excuses to avoid confronting it. But Janice wouldn't hear of it. When he tried to talk to her about it, she became furious with him for discussing their personal life with a complete stranger, and she blamed him for being the source of all their problems, for not being there when she needed him. She blamed the police force for taking him away from her and from the children, accusing him of being selfish and uncaring, and not wanting to lose his temper with the children there. Steele had left and spent the night in the police dormitory after getting good and drunk. He stayed there away from home for 2 days, and when he returned, they fought once more, with Janice accusing him of seeing someone else because he hadn't come home. They argued, or rather, Janice argued, for the most of the evening, and Steele went to sleep on the couch. And in the middle of the night, she came to him dressed in a flimsy nightgown. Actually, this says a filmy nightgown. Filmy. A filmy nightgown, sure. And they made passionate love, and she told him that she forgave him. However, the next day, the coolness had returned, and it continued that way, blowing hot and cold, with Steele coming to realize that he was living with a stranger, a woman he simply didn't know anymore. Perhaps he had never really known. He withdrew more and more into himself and concentrated all his energies on the job, occasionally seeing Father Casey for an informal confession in the bar across the street from St. Vincent's. The two men grew very close. They hardly ever talked about Steele's marriage after that first time. And Father Casey understood that Steele was not the sort of man for whom bearing his soul was easy. For Steele, he was not so much a father confessor as a drinking buddy, which was in its own way no less important, because he knew that Steele needed someone he could talk to who understood his problems, even if they did not actually discuss them in detail. Liam Casey sympathized with Steele's situation, but it pained him that there was so little he could do. As a pragmatic, modern man, he realized that divorce might be the best solution, but as a Catholic and a priest at that, it was not an option he could advise Steele to consider in the post-apocalypse. And Steele was not a child. He knew what all the options were, but he was the sort of man who, once he made a commitment, stuck by it no matter what. Father Casey respected him for that, but he wished that there was something more he could do to help them. Steele was not a very happy man. When Steele came home that evening, it was to an empty apartment. There was a rather terse note on the table from Janice, telling him that she had gone with the children to her mother's place for dinner, and pointedly reminding him that he was supposed to have gone with them, but he'd been late again, and she decided not to wait. He could get something from the refrigerator. Steele had not remembered that they were supposed to go to her mother's for dinner that evening. It was the sort of thing that would have been easy for him to forget. Janice's mother was a widow whose husband had succumbed to virus 4, the fourth mutation of the plague that attacked the motor system. For most of Janice's life, her father had been a cripple. Slowly wasting away, and his death had left her other an angry and embittered woman. She loved her grandchildren, but made no secret of her dislike for Steele. The occasional visits that they paid to her were always a torture for him. Perhaps subconsciously, he'd want to forget that they were to visit her tonight. It would mean needing another argument with Janice, but at least it would spare him that spiteful old woman's presence. Steele went to the refrigerator and took out a beer. He sat down in front of the television set and watched the news. As usual, it was all bad. A war between two competing street gangs had spilled over from Harlem into the north section of Midtown, with regular patrol and strike force units called in. There was a dramatic footage of police choppers strafing the streets below, buildings in flames, police units and street gang members armed with fully automatic weapons skirmishing in the alleys in the rubble. One of the cameramen who got too close was critically wounded, and they showed him being loaded on a stretcher into a waiting ambulance. There was a story about the government still trying to negotiate with Texas, trying to bring it back into the fold without any apparent success. The talks were deadlocked once again. One of the mobs had assassinated the district attorney of Chicago. The National Guard was trying to put down civil riots over perpetual food shortages in Detroit. War had broken out in the Midwest once again, or Mideast. Mideast. Okay. It was the same tired litany. War, shootings, killings, bombings, rapes and muggings, power outages and shortages, always the same shortages. It never seemed to end. Disgusted, Steele turned off the TV and finished his beer. He glanced at his watch. Almost 7 o'clock. Janice would be home soon. He simply wasn't up to facing her tonight. He packed a small overnight bag, left her a brief note, then went to spend the night in the police dorms. The end of that chapter. Brilliant.